future is now. And welcome to the SVK Crypto Podcast. 15 minutes of crypto fame.
My name is Charles Story. I'll be your host the next 15 minutes, becoming live from the City of London, Shoreditch. So let's get down to business. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we have a slightly different show. We have a special guest speaker on, and tonight I want to get an understanding of my guest. The background, the origin, why he does what he does. Tonight we might have to switch off the stop clock. And I also want to apologize to Andy Warhol for not keeping it within the 15-minute parameter. I know you're going to enjoy this. If you're out walking the dog, if you're on your commute to work, if you're in the gym working out, you're going to enjoy the show because tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we have the one and only Rob Finch, founder of ICO Alert, the Everything EOS podcast host, along with his co-host, Zach Gull, founder and CEO of a top 21 block producer by the name of Cypherglass. He's going to be telling us everything, giving us the inside scoop to everything EOS at this current point in time, what's happening, what's going on, his view as a block producer, what he's seeing in the market, and what his predictions are with EOS. So let's get in and let's get down to business and let's jump straight into the interview. I think with this episode, Rob, I just really want to find out more about you. And I know you have a brief background in gaming. So I think what we're going to do is start from day one, where this all began. And like many other crypto greats, it started with gaming. And I think we'll grow from there.
Yeah. So I started playing a game most people know that had tens of millions of players in its heyday, World of Warcraft. And over the last, how many years has it been now? I guess like 14 years or so, have sunk 400 plus days of playtime into it. So that's as if I played straight for 400 days. That's the amount of playtime I've accrued on some of these characters.
Let's look into that. So if you played straight for 400 days, actual game time, yeah. What does that mean for actual time? Logging in, logging out, like that must be...
Yeah, it's almost 10,000 hours. And combined across all the characters, it's probably north of that.
Well, have you read that book Outliers by Malcolm? I forgot his last name, right? And he said you have to spend 10,000 at anything to be great at it. So hopefully you're pretty good now.
Yeah, I think so. I'm decent.
So how do you transition from World of Warcraft to crypto? When was your introduction?
Yeah, so I got introduced to crypto through Bitcoin in 2013. It was right before I dropped out of art school. So I actually got a photography scholarship to art school in Chicago at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. It's the big one there associated with that big museum. And was there for about 2.5 years before I decided to drop out in 2013. And along that time, I stumbled across a thread on Reddit that was actually the contest post for designing, since I was in the design program there, designing that what is now the famous Magic Internet Money ad for Bitcoin. And I saw it. I didn't actually compete in the contest or anything, but that got me into that Bitcoin subreddit at the time, which had a ton of useful info, and just sort of dove down the rabbit hole. So growing up, I was in detention a lot and got suspended for having my hair too long or not wearing the proper clothes and dress code.
So
all that serious stuff, not wearing proper dress code. But I think my point with that is that I think I've always had a natural distrust for authority or a dislike for authority. And because of that, when I saw Bitcoin, hey, there's no authority. There's nobody here that can tell you you can or can't send a transaction. There's no bank that can come in and freeze your funds. That I think is what really drew me in and then enabled me to jump down the rabbit hole and sink probably close to 400 days of playtime into researching crypto as well.
That's amazing, dude. So you always had a bit of a trouble streak, right? You were a bit of a troublemaker, a bit of a rebel. Right. So this fitted quite well with the anti-establishment liberalism that it had to begin with. I guess it kind of suited your mindset as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it aligned pretty clearly. And I was like, oh, wow, this is the future. Imagine what we could do on this. And we were talking about dApps at the time in 2013, before dApps were even a thing. Like, oh, imagine, everybody in the world could have a bank account, or you could have, when a drone flies over the airspace above your house, it could send you a micropayment for using that airspace since you own it in the US. And all kinds of ideas were flowing that are now, I think, coming to fruition. But definitely jumped down the rabbit hole.
So what price did you buy Bitcoin at?
I think the first time I bought it, first time I saw it, I think it was at like $82. And I think I maybe bought it slightly higher than that. I remember the first experience I had buying Bitcoin. So I think Mt. Gox was around at the time. And I think Bitstamp was as well. But I ended up sending like $400 in cash through, it was either MoneyGram or Western Union, to some guy in Japan who then sent me some Bitcoin over the internet. So like 5 hours later, after I sent the money, thinking like, oh God, did I just lose like half of my rent money? Then suddenly I got the Bitcoin in my wallet.
Isn't it crazy how things have changed? And like people look at the way we do stuff now with exchanges and they're like, oh, you know, I don't know if I can trust it, right? But before we were sending money to like random people, like hoping they would deliver.
Well, I remember so vividly, I walked out of my apartment in Chicago and walked to the local CVS, which is like a convenience store. And the Western Union or MoneyGram thing wasn't working. So I was like, oh, okay, you know, maybe it's a sign, I shouldn't do it. And I started walking home and I went, wait a minute, there's a grocery store across the street. So I went in there and their machine was working and I ended up sending it. And I'm so glad I did.
So the question is, Rob, did he sell any?
Oh, yeah, I did. I definitely did. Yeah, I mean, there was a... So I held some, though, through the entire 2013 to 2015, but there were periods definitely where I sold Bitcoin and then ended up selling pretty much my entire stash of Bitcoin for EOS.
Okay, cool. We'll get to that in a sec. So after you got involved to Bitcoin, what was the next stage? Like what happened after that? Because now you've bought Bitcoin, you're in the game, you got skin in the game. What was next? So how did you transition from a student lifestyle to getting involved full time? Like what was the transition period like?
Yeah, so it was actually lagging a couple years after I first got in. Obviously 2013 to 2015 was that huge bear market. So I spent, you know, thousands of hours across those 2 years and then the years following just doing research and learning how the tech worked. So one of the things that I didn't mention while I was at art school, I was teaching myself how to code, how to build websites. And I had ended up getting client work and got enough client work where I was like, wait a minute, why am I, you know, throwing $50,000 a year into this school on top of the scholarship when I could be, you know, actually making money and be cash positive, not continue going into debt. So that's initially what made me make the leap. And then I was funneling some of the money I was making in web design into Bitcoin and sort of, you know, started that whole cycle. But it wasn't until early 2017, after my brother had actually discovered Ethereum and sort of pointed me to that as sort of a returning of the favor. You know, I pointed him to Bitcoin, he pointed me to Ethereum. but I got into that in 2016. In early 2017, we launched ICOalert.com, and that's when the full-time switch happened, and I was full-time in crypto.
So talk to me about ICO Alert, because that was a huge website, and still is, by the way. I know it's not your full-time focus at the minute, and we'll get into that in a second, but like, so ICO Alert, what was the mission? What were you trying to do with that? What was the original vision with that?
Yeah, so in early 2017, as ICOs started to really catch on, you know, we had a couple really big ICOs that raised a significant amount of money at that time, you know, $30, $40, $50 million. And I kept going to all these smaller ICO tracking websites and found that, oh, wow, they're just, you know, people are paying them to list their ICO. Nobody really has a complete list of all the ICOs. So I remember one weekend, you know, talking to my brother, hey, I think I'm going to figure out what all of the ICOs are and just put them in a list, put them on a website so that we could personally track it. Because we were doing a lot of investing in these ICOs at the time, you know, ICO flips, some long-term stuff, sort of a mix of it all. But basically sat down and decided one weekend to you know, compile a big list that was truly comprehensive. And it kind of exploded from there. I remember posting back on Reddit, it got a ton of traction. Like, I don't know, it was something like 1,000 users in the first day, which at the time was, you know, amazing to me. Wow. That I could even get 1,000 people to come look at it. Obviously then trailed off and then built way back up to the point where in the heat of the bear market, I think we had 30 to 40,000 unique users a day. So it really got up there as a pretty big website in the crypto space. But that was our mission, was just to track every single ICO that existed and put it out there for the people.
Well, that's great you guys did that, right? Because I remember those times where people would be looking for information and they were pretty much looking for an edge in the market. Yeah. And there were so many dodgy websites out there. So you guys obviously had a good service, had a nice user experience. You did really well. So what was ICO's role? Like what you guys did? Like, were you taking on money? Were you just displaying ICOs? Like ICO Alert as well, you did some kind of paid advertising and stuff like that?
Yeah. So first and foremost, we listed every single ICO for free. So if you were running an ICO, if it wasn't obviously a scam, we would put it up on the website for free. But then the way we monetized was just by offering people premium spots on the website, or, you know, we would send an email blast to the 30,000 people we had that signed up that wanted exclusive info about ICOs. So through that really, you know, allowed us to go after, you know, more quality ICOs that wanted to advertise, other ICOs that maybe had a great concept and a great team, but couldn't get out there, and sort of elevate them to the top while making money in the process.
So Rob, you got an interesting story of how you got into Bitcoin. I hope there's just as interesting one how you got into EOS. I hope it wasn't like, oh, I bought it and that was that. You know what I mean? I hope there's like another fate, like a moment where you're like, wow, that was a moment just then.
Yeah, there is another moment. It's less serendipitous, I guess, where, you know, I didn't necessarily stumble upon it, but there was a gentleman who is at Block One now, named by Michael Cow. I think he is now running EOS Global. But at the time, it actually reached out and said, hey, you know, we're doing the EOS ICO. Can you maybe do some advertising? And I don't think they ended up actually buying any advertising, but we had some good talks. And through his email, I noticed, you know, oh, wow, he has an at Block.One email. Let me go check this out and see what it is. And I noticed on their website, they said, oh, at the time, you know, the old Block One website, we use two products to, you know, further a mission. They had Ethereum, which of course I had heard about at the time, and then a new one called EOS. And I clicked on the EOS link and I looked and I stumbled upon a presentation that Dan Larimer and I think Brendan Bloomer were giving at Consensus 2017, where they sort of introduced EOS and talked about, you know, the scaling problems that Ethereum and Bitcoin had and how it was so much different. So if I had never gotten that email from Michael Cow and had that little conversation with him, maybe I never would have stumbled upon it. But it was very much a similar jumping down the rabbit hole moment where I realized, wow, like this is going to be huge, not just in the crypto space, but beyond. And I haven't felt that way. The way I felt about EOS is something that I hadn't felt about a crypto since I first discovered Bitcoin.
That's amazing, dude. And like, it's such a great story. You kind of like, I'm not going to say fell into it, but kind of like came across it, right?
Yeah.
So what was the kind of the next move for you? Did you kind of, were you like, right, I just got to double down on this thing? Because by the way, when you were getting involved, it was still the ICO. Like we still didn't have anything yet. So you were buying into the vision. And
oh, absolutely.
So like what was your move? Did you get involved in the ICO? Were you trying to build a position there?
Yeah, so mostly buying on exchanges just to sort of get around the legality where Block One prohibited people from going in the ICO. But I was just doing as much research as I could and trying to find as much info. So while there wasn't a ton of info about EOS available, there was a ton of info out about the people that were creating it. So of course, Dan Larimer had made BitShares and Steemit, so dumped a bunch of time into, you know, looking into that. And I realized, oh, wow, you know, BitShares was the first decentralized exchange to ever exist. This guy was clearly a pioneer there. Looking at Steemit, technically, it can scale up to something like 100,000 transactions per second and is the most used blockchain platform in the world, even above Bitcoin and Ethereum at that time, even though Steem and Steemit really didn't have a lot of public attention. So I started noticing these things like, wow, all of the projects that Dan works on seem to have been pretty revolutionary. And it gave me more faith in EOS to then, you know, look past some of the stuff. There were some theories going around, oh, Block One's just, you know, going to take the money and run because they had that crazy disclaimer on their site to protect them legally. You know, they're never going to release any software. But I think the more and more research I did, the more confident I became that this was going to be something that could truly solve the problems that were holding the blockchain space back.
Well, it's one thing to be an investor like you were and we were, but it's another thing to become so invested whereby you want to be part of the ecosystem and you want to help everyone. So what was the transition to block producer? Like, were you just like, listen, I got to become a block producer now?
Yeah. So my brother and I, through our little investments, we never ran a LISC block producer or, you know, one of the delegates on LISC, which is very similar to a block producer, but we were in some pools there and then eventually did run our own little delegates for a platform called Rise, which I don't think is even really around anymore. But at one point had a bunch of delegates on Rise that we were running and sort of saw the potential there, you know, for these networks to be a part of the network, to not just have to buy a ton of equipment like you have to do in Bitcoin and go out and spend millions of dollars on it. But it seemed way more accessible where, oh, wow, you can, you know, lobby people for their vote and actually become, you know, the miners on the network seemed very appealing. So then when EOS came out and we realized that was also a DPoS delegated proof of stake system where people vote in the miners, you know, the light bulb kind of went off and I went, oh, wow, this is the holy grail. We have to be one of these block producers so that we can support the ecosystem and lobby for votes and be one of those big people in the ecosystem without having to go out and spend millions and millions of dollars on mining hardware.
And also, like, you know, Byzantine fault tolerance, like what was your thoughts on that originally when you first came across it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty interesting problem. If anybody is listening and has no idea what we're talking about, look up the Byzantine general problem, which is how do you really coordinate a bunch of different generals who can't communicate with each other in some way? Right. There are better explanations about it online that will do a much better job than I do. But I think the consensus mechanism they have with BFT DPoS on EOS is pretty interesting. And I think really allows it to do a lot of what it does today.
So from the journey of being a blockchain user, when did you first announce that? Because that would have been this year. So when did you guys get all the hardware? When did you get kind of prepared for this? And because you guys, obviously I'm a big fan of the Everything Yours podcast that yourself and Zach all do. So when did you set everything up for becoming a block producer?
Yeah, so that was November 2017, where we kind of made the decision, you know, hey, we're going to do this thing. And we actually got to the point where in, I think it was February or March, where we were ready to go. We had a big infrastructure partner online, which was a, I don't know if they're a Fortune 500 company, but they're a big company. We were ready to go live. Hey, these are the guys that we're going with. And then something happened. And the something that happened was we found out that their team, right before we were about to sign the deal, and, you know, launch this company, launch the block producer, they were being investigated by the SEC for a sale round that they were doing. And we went, oh, okay, red flag here. We can't, you know, tie ourselves to this if they're being investigated by the SEC. It brought up some other red flags. So we had to basically start from scratch and go out and build our own infrastructure team. So it took us then the next few months all the way up until just 1 month before the EOS mainnet actually launched. So it was in May that we came out and said, hey, you know, we're Cypherglass, we're going to be a block producer. And in the 4 to 5 weeks between the time that we announced and the time the mainnet launched, we did enough, I think, within the community to get the votes to then be in the top 21 when the chain launched.
So let's talk about that journey a little bit. So Cypherglass, which is the block producer that you obviously are a founder of and currently the CEO of as well, right? But you guys had a few issues to start with. So I remember that I followed you guys quite religiously in a sense, whereby like, you weren't in the top 21 for a while and there was something going on with Bitfinex's wallet, which in turn brought you back into the game, right? So what was that transition?
So we noticed, you know, one day we were in the top 21, I think we were number 10. And then suddenly the next day we lost some insane amount of votes. I think it was 30 million votes. And, you know, of course we were all panicking. We went and looked at the blockchain, who unvoted us? And it turned out that all of the Bitfinex proxy votes that we had, which are the proxy accounts they use to vote on behalf of their users, just totally eliminated us. We had zero votes suddenly from Bitfinex. So we started doing some research. We, you know, deposited, I think you needed $10,000 worth of EOS on their exchange to actually vote. We deposited it. We started looking through their voting files because you can see very transparently who people are voting for. And we noticed that in the most recent round of the voting JSON files, Cypherglass wasn't anywhere. Nobody had cast a single vote. You couldn't see us as an option to vote for. We were basically eliminated from the system. So, you know, rather than going out loud and accusing Bitfinex, oh, you know, you removed us, this is malicious, we eventually got in touch with Paolo, the CTO there, who runs their block producer. Guy. But oh yeah, he has so much going on. I don't know how he does it all in a day. But we ended up getting in touch with him, you know, talked to him about the problem, and James, one of our tech guys, ended up working with him for, I think, 2 to 3 weeks to fix their voting tool, make it easier for them to re-vote, easier for people to vote on the platform. And eventually it got fixed. People were able to vote for us again. And we got, I think, we didn't get the full 30 million back, but I think we got 17 million back from them, which ended up getting us, you know, way up in the ranks again.
I love that story because you're not like, you know, trying to bring attention to yourselves and you're like being victimized, right? You're like, hey, listen, you got an issue and we're going to help you fix it. Like, and you deployed one of your guys, right? One of the tech team to literally help them fix this issue, which they did. And you guys got brought back into the 21 club.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been in and out of it now. So we were just in it for a couple of weeks. I think we just dropped out recently. I think we're now 24, 25, but it's definitely a crazy process. You know, some weeks we're in it, some weeks we're out, but ultimately I think I like that because, you know, it's constantly challenging us to do more, to put out more videos, put out more content, you know, continue engaging with the community. Whereas I think if we and others just sat in the top 21 forever, maybe that drive would go away. So I kind of like the fight to always get back in.
No, I love that as well, man. It's a 24/7, 365 challenge. And what's great about that for a community or an EOS token holder is the fact that everyone has to compete. So they have to add as much value as they can to the community to stay relevant and get the attention to stay on them.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the biggest misunderstandings people have about EOS. They say, oh, there are 21 block producers, they must never change, right? But the reality is there are 21 block producers that are actively producing the blocks, that these are the sort of active miners on the network. But beyond that, there are 60 or more standby block producers that are ready to take their spot, that frequently get shuffled around. And then beyond that, there are hundreds of other block producer candidates that haven't made it to standby yet, that are even fighting just to get in the standby rank. So there are hundreds of different organizations and entities around the world fighting to be block producers, where it is a very, very decentralized system because the top 21 is changing all the time. And you do, like you said, have to constantly fight to add value to stay in it.
So how many book producers are at the minute, even on standby, like in aggregate?
Oh my goodness, I think I can look the number up. It's several hundred different accounts that have actually registered to be a producer. You do the reg producer command. Technically, anybody can do it, so I'm sure some of those aren't real. But right now, there are 123 accounts that have at least, or 123 different block producers that have at least 1 million votes. And then beyond that, there are more than 400, looks like 421 block producers that have at least some votes.
Wow, that's a lot. And by the way, I think that's going to get like, that's going to increase rapidly, like in multiples, like, because we're so early on this, and wait till everyone else finds out the role of a block producer. And I think that ease to market on a block producer is pretty good. But as you said, to actually stay in the top 21 is like a whole game within itself. And that's the challenge.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the top block producer right now, who at this moment, which will probably change later, is EOS Lau Mau. They have just over 100 million EOS voted towards them, whereas we're down at number 26 with 66 million votes. So it is a fight. If we want to get back in now, I think we need something like 8 million votes, which I think is about the amount of vote decay we have. So it's definitely possible, and I'm sure we'll get back in. But it is a constant fight to continually get more and more votes to stay, you know, competitive.
There's something else that's quite relevant when we discuss this, is the fact that Block One own 10% of the EOS tokens out there. And I know there's been like several talks about them potentially voting on block producers. Like, what's your take on that current situation? And what's your understanding of it?
Yeah, so they put out an interesting blog post basically reserving their right to vote with 100 million tokens that they do have. However, they did sort of put up a couple qualifications for them voting. So the main thing and the most important thing they said was that they will not vote with those 100 million tokens until they represent a minority share of the total tokens voted on the network. So even though we have, you know, 55% of all EOS tokens are staked right now, it's a much, much smaller percentage that are still actively voting. So if Block One came in right now, you know, if the number one block producer has 100 million votes and Block One can cast 100 million, if they came in right now and voted for 21 people, they would basically choose who the top 21 is. So they have said that they're not going to vote until their votes have a much less impact on who will actually be in the top 21 and who won't, because they don't want to be a central authority that's controlling it. And I think that's great.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And they don't want to cast kind of like a, you know, they don't want to get to the point where it's like you can't even compete anymore. Because at the minute, as you said, it's such a level playing field. Like no one's really that far ahead than anyone else. I mean, yeah, you may be this week, but like next week, that could all change like rapidly.
Oh, absolutely. It's a constant fight, and it's a lot of fun. It's cool to see, you know, what the other block producers are coming out with. We were at that SVK crypto event in London last week and met a couple of the block producers there. And it's just so cool that we're all, you know, competing with each other, but also sort of collaborating in some ways and all rooting for the network as a whole.
Well, let's talk about the event that we did here at SVK Crypto. By the way, you did an amazing job speaking. So thank you so much for coming down. But let's talk about the bounty. I think we'll start with the bounty, then end with the bet. But the bounty that you've put out, you've put $100,000 of your own money out there for someone to create a wallet, right?
Yeah, so it was a $100,000 EOS hardware wallet bounty. So $50,000 of that has already been given out to a gentleman by the name of Crypto Fairy, who built the Ledger Nano S integration. So Ledger looked at his code, looked at his wallet code, and approved it. And now if you own a Ledger Nano S and you also hold EOS, you can store your EOS and your airdrops on the Ledger, which is pretty awesome and has taken some other networks more than a year to get that implemented, whereas this was done just, you know, 3 months after the launch of the EOS mainnet. But the other $50,000 of that $100,000 is for Trezor. So Trezor integration. Trezor is another very popular hardware wallet. And I know some people are working on that right now. So hopefully, you know, here in the coming weeks and months, we have somebody that submits that and then wins the other $50,000.
I love that. And by the way, for full disclosure, like you're not getting like a kickback from Ledger. You're not getting a kickback from Trezor. You're doing this because you want to do this, because you want to integrate it, because you see the future being EOS.
Yeah, it's coming out of my bank account. Ledger's not giving us anything for it. I think maybe they would have eventually gotten around to, you know, making it themselves. But right before the mainnet launched and we put out this challenge, it was mainly because we wanted the wallet. You know, we wanted Ledger integration. We wanted Trezor integration. And we know the community does too. So it's been awesome to be able to provide that.
So let's talk about the bet.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the bet, because the bet, by the way, I think the bet is like one of the main reasons you guys got into the 21. It's like you have this guy, it's like, oh, that's kind of cool, Rob Finch. Yeah, he's kind of cool. Cypherglass. Oh, yeah, that's cool. What? He put a bet on for like, what is the bet's a $1 million bet, right? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, so it's called the $1 million US bet, and it's called that because that's the max either of us could lose in the bet, depending on, you know, what parameters are hit.
All right. But I think that, by the way, like really shows that you've got skin in the game. Like yeah. If anything was to prove that, that bet, like, I don't see any other blog producers making that bet, by the way.
That's fair, yeah.
Let's be honest. Like I haven't heard of anyone else. And I know most of the blog producers here in London anyway. I don't hear any other $1 million bet. So why don't you bring the listeners up to speed of this bet and the details of that?
Yeah, so the $1 million US bet, if you just search $1 million US bet on YouTube, you can see more in depth and some of the reasons for it. But the bet basically stated, you know, it was with somebody, Q, I was working with at ICO Alert, the VP of business development there, stated if the price of one EOS token hits $1,000 on the Binance Bitcoin EOS pair by December 31st, basically the end of this year, then he would owe me $1 million in EOS, which is, you know, denominated as 1,000 EOS. And then the flip side, if it doesn't hit that, let's say it hits $100, I would then owe him whatever the current price is times 1,000 EOS. So in that case, let's say EOS hits $100 by December 31st, I basically owe him $100,000 payable in EOS.
Okay, so but let's give a bit of color to this because you're not betting just on the price itself. Like you're basically aggregating all the airdrops that come through. And by your calculations, by the interplay this year, including all of those airdrops, that's one EOS with inclusion of all the different airdrops coming through would equate more than $1,000.
Exactly. So the theory is that, you know, as more and more people can actually raise funds by doing an airdrop, where, you know, people like the EOSTACK team, who's another great block producer, came out, they airdropped about 1 billion tokens out to the community members, and they kept, yeah. You know, so a one-to-one basis, excuse me, for every one EOS token you hold, you got one EOSTACK token totally free in your wallet. But they also kept about 300 million tokens for themselves. So when, you know, on these decentralized exchanges, when people valued their token at something like 5 cents, they then raised something like $15 million with the 300 million tokens they kept for themselves. So the theory is that as more and more developers come out, you know, they do an airdrop, they launch their project and let the market value it to raise funds. The more and more people do that, then it sort of starts this chain reaction effect where more devs come to EOS and buy more EOS and lock up more of the supply to run their dApps. But then more people see it's a good funding model, so they come in and do an airdrop and give more airdrops to the token holders. And it's this sort of airdrop feedback loop that I explain in that $1 million EOS bet video that I think is sort of starting to happen now, you know, with the several dozen airdrops we've seen, but I think will happen even more so over the next year as the ecosystem continues to grow and thrive.
So how are you feeling with this bet, Rob? Are you feeling good? are you feeling good?
I think it's possible still, yeah. But I would not be surprised if I end up losing the bet at the end of the year, since we're looking at 3 months left till the end of the year. So it would be it's definitely possible. You know, we looked at Ethereum last year, which went from less than 10 upwards of $1,200. So it's definitely happened before. Obviously, you know, total supplies are a little bit different, but staking affects that. So I'm confident in the possibility. I think there is still a slim chance it could happen, but also would totally not be surprised to see myself lose the bet, and I'm totally fine with that.
Well, you know, listen, you know, we still have some time. We're seeing volumes pick up in the overall market, but, you know, hopefully we can get you past that $1,000 mark.
Yeah, we'll see. We need everybody.
If anyone's out there that has some EOS spare, you know what to do with it. Help Rob out and get some money on CypherGlass at least, because you don't want Rob losing $1 million, man. That's not cool.
Right, absolutely. Now we're both hedged either way in EOS, so either way we'll both be fine. But it's a fun bet to put out there and be able to, you know, sort of do alongside the community. I have people messaging me every day, like, if the price goes down 10%, people go, "Hey man, are you all right?" And it goes up 10%, and they're like, "Here we go, we're going." So,
oh my god, I love that. So let's talk about account creation, Rob, because this has been like a big topic of conversation for a while now, and we're starting to see the price come down. But like, what's been your take on it as a blog producer? Because you're really at the forefront of people asking questions, being approached by the community. How have you felt this being developed? Where do you think we are now, and where do you think we're going with account creation?
Yeah, so in order to make an EOS account right now, you have to pay, you know, generally a couple dollars. I think you can get it as cheap as 99 cents to basically buy RAM, which is a resource on the network that allows the network to store your account so that people can send tokens to it. But then, of course, once you have that account, you can send transactions for free for life. So it's basically a one-time fee to sort of get into the ecosystem. So what we saw at the beginning of the launch was that RAM prices, since you can actually buy and sell RAM on the network, RAM prices went totally out of control. I forget what it ended up, you know, topping out at, but went to the point where it was costing $20, $30, $40 to set up an EOS account, which was just cost prohibitive for most people to even come into the ecosystem. But since that point, we've seen a lot of different proposals, a lot of different fixes implemented, which have brought that the cost of the account now down to something like 99 cents. If you download the EOS Lynx YNX app, you can make an account for a dollar. A couple of these proposals, one was implemented by the block producers, where we basically reduced the amount of RAM required to actually make an account from four kilobytes to 3 kilobytes. So that reduced the cost by 25%. There was a proposal that came through where now every day a certain amount of RAM actually gets added to the total RAM pool. So over time, the cost of RAM actually goes down as the supply continues to go up. So these proposals and some others that are coming in the future, like sidechains, will continue to lower the cost of account creation. But my personal opinion of it now, I think it's at a great point where, you know, EOS Lynx is doing it for 99 cents. Some other apps are doing it for a couple bucks. And soon Block One will come out with their own wallet and they say they're going to give away accounts for free. So that should just totally eliminate that problem altogether.
By the way, as well, like obviously not you guys, but there were a lot of block producers who made a lot of money because they bought a lot of RAM because producing accounts, right? And like some of them I heard have had like 10x returns and they'd be dumping it in the market, like selling it. Like I don't want to mention any names, but like, you know, a lot of people made a lot of money out of that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think RAM did something like a 20-25x within.
Was it that much?
Oh, wow. It was a massive run from the bottom to the top. Assuming you bought into RAM on day one, now it's sort of just a downward chart. There are some occasional, you know, pumps of maybe a big dApp developer buying a bunch of a RAM to do an airdrop, but it's pretty much settled out now. But that was a crazy week or 2 weeks when all that was going on.
And what's your kind of view on the EOS resource renting and rent distribution? Because that's something that's been talked about a lot, right? That was kind of announced early August. But, you know, Dan came out and was talking about the ability for renting and the distribution of that on the EOS network. Like, what's your view on that?
Yeah. So right now, if you're listening, you're not familiar, holding an EOS token basically gives you ownership over a certain amount of resources on the network. So those are things like CPU and bandwidth, which is basically your ability to send transactions. So if you own 1% of the tokens, all of the EOS tokens that exist, you're guaranteed to always own at least 1% of the computational power and the bandwidth and soon eventually the storage on that network. So what that is provides a pretty interesting resource allocation model where if you own those tokens, you own the CPU, you own the bandwidth associated with those tokens, you can actually lease that out to people who need it but don't want to buy the tokens themselves. So if there's a dApp developer that wants to, you know, run a beta version of their dApp on EOS and doesn't want to invest in tokens yet, they can come to a token holder on a marketplace and say, hey, you know, I'll pay you, you know, 3% of the cost of your EOS every month or every year or whatever it will be to lease that CPU and bandwidth power for you. And then through that same marketplace, you can delegate, you know, that bandwidth to them. So I think it's going to be pretty interesting and really change the game in terms of where EOS tokens are held. So I think we're going to see a lot of people withdraw their tokens from exchanges so that they can lease them out to other people. But I think this is one of the things that really differentiates EOS from other platforms, where other platforms, you know, you're paying a transaction fee anytime you want to take an action. On EOS, it's free because you sort of own the power that allows you to send transactions. So that's why I think it's been compared to, you know, digital real estate, where you own 1% of this digital real estate of being able to send transactions and communicate with other people. And you can then lease that out, sort of like if you buy a house, you can lease it out to tenants.
Yeah, I think like what they're looking to do there is massive, by the way. And it kind of links back into the universal resource inheritance as well, right? Like that's huge. And this is pretty fresh. I think it was first announced like September 16th or 17th. But, you know, this all links back into the universal resource inheritance. Would you be so kind to like give your view on that as well, Rob? Like what's your kind of take on that? Are you excited about this? Do you think there's going to be some big challenges? Do you have any concerns?
Yeah, so URI, or Universal Resource Inheritance, is a proposal from Dan Larimer, so the CTO at Block One and sort of the brains behind EOS, where it's just an interesting proposal or thought experiment now, which would effectively give people some kind of claim over the Earth's resources. So it's a way of essentially paying people some kind of basic income or some kind of, you know, some amount of money every year that will in turn over a 100-year period totally shift wealth away from the people that are extracting value from the system and to the people that are adding value. I don't know. I have some sort of philosophical problems with it where I'm not a huge fan, and we've talked about this on the Everything EOS podcast, not a huge fan of just giving people money for for not doing anything. But I think, you know, Dan is a really, really smart guy. So because I respect what he's done in the past, I'm always willing to listen and read his blog posts and listen to the talks he gives about it. Because I think there may be maybe something there. It's just a matter of packaging it in the right way where, you know, it sort of benefits everyone and everyone's okay with it. But it's a really interesting model. And, you know, if somebody came to you and said, hey, if you set up an EOS account, you'll get free money every year, I think we'd see a massive amount of people flow into the system.
And, you know, not to go down the philosophical route, but a lot of the thought leaders in this industry, you know, including Dan himself, really describe themselves as kind of Austrian economists, right? Like, they really have that kind of left of center viewpoint. And I think that's really interesting to see because I know Jimmy Song has that, Roger Ver has that. Like, they're massively read up on the Austrian kind of policies and economic, you know, like views financially on how people should live their lives. And it's interesting because Dan describes himself in a similar kind of mindset. I don't know what the correlation is between that. Like, it's kind of strange, right? Like, between kind of trying to free the world and also kind of, you know, having this other thing where you're trying to bring everyone with you for the journey, which I guess kind of, in that mindset is kind of cool. But no, I hear what you're saying. It's kind of like, it's like, if you hold it, you're kind of free, right? It's kind of like,
there are definitely some problems with it, but I mean, to your point, I think a lot of them are read up on a lot of this. I think it's pretty interesting, and I don't know if that comes from like the libertarian background that a lot of people in crypto have, which is like, you know, true freedom, free markets. But I don't know, this kind of goes against it in some ways, but also has some similarities. But it'll be very, very interesting to see what happens with this and see how it develops. That's for sure.
I think it's easy to be a libertarian, right? When you have nothing. And I think that's an easy kind of mindset to adopt, right? But like, no, honestly, like think about it. Like there's a lot of people in this business and I'm not talking about EOS. I'm talking about like everything. Mm. They've made a lot of money and because they hold a lot of crypto, they got an early fair play to them. They took that risk. They have a lot of money now. And you wonder like if their kind of mindset has kind of changed, you know, now they drive a Lambo and it's like, are you still really libertarian? Do you still think the same things or do you kind of like the materialistic luxuries money can bring?
Yeah, that's a fair point. It's interesting to see what happens to people. You know, they say I've heard the saying, there are two things that show your true self. The first one is alcohol. And then the second one is money, where, you know, your true self kind of comes out. So maybe that's why some people have changed their tone.
It's interesting, dude. I mean, like, and you have to think as well, Rob, like we're in this so early. Like we really are. Yeah. Like talking to other people in the community, you think you're kind of late, right? Cause some guy bought EOS at like, you know, like 50 cents. And you're like, oh damn, like I bought in at like $3. Like, ah. Oh. But like in the long run, like you talk to anyone on the street here in Shoreditch, East London, like they don't even know what crypto is. Like,
oh yeah. I mean, at this point, to compare this to the internet, we're still a bunch of nerds sitting around in the computer room at our university talking about, you know, what we might be able to do with this new machine we've discovered. That's kind of where we are with blockchains and crypto. There's a bunch of really, really smart, really talented, you know, sometimes crazy people around the world sort of figuring out, you know, what are the main use cases for this new tech going to be? How is this going to change the world? But so, so few people in the world right now are even involved in this, let alone own any of the crypto. So to people who think that they're late to this, you know, new frontier, this Web 3.0 arena, are just totally wrong. You know, you're still an early adopter along with everybody else, along with the people who were there in 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13. I mean, everybody right now is an early adopter.
Yeah, especially in these current levels as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's interesting because, you know, you see day after day, like big corporations getting into the space, but you have to remember like those guys are really smart. Like they hire the smartest guys in the industry and they never miss a trick. Like how many people do you think were stumped out that they didn't have a website in the 90s? Like the ROI on that was huge. And I think a lot of people have kind of lived through that. And they're like, we're not going to miss out on this. Like we can't afford to. Like Dell made a move today. IBM, obviously, as we know, massively involved in this. Walmart. So it's interesting to see kind of the eagerness of all these big corporations.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think if you look at just what a transformative impact the internet had on society and on, you know, businesses and these massive corporations, they're looking at the blockchain now. And when they start to understand the potential implications of it, they go, okay, actually, maybe we should give this a serious look because it could dramatically change the way that, you know, businesses are run in the future.
It's interesting as well. So you've got like private blockchains, public blockchains. I mean, my personal view is that with the private blockchains, they're not going to see the same scale of innovation that a public blockchain would because of the open source nature. But it's interesting to see all these banks and consortiums, you know, really doubling down on the private protocols out there. But it'll be interesting to see in the next kind of 10 years, you know, where they're at, and see if the public ones have just, you know, massively overtaken them in development.
Yeah, I think the private blockchains will definitely, you know, have a use. I think the main use case is when you're in a small closed system, like a bank is a great example. You know, if there are 10 major banks around the world and they want to kind of keep each other in check with the deposits and withdrawals and transfers that their customers are doing in between all their banks, a private blockchain is perfect for them because they all have the keys for it. They don't have to, you know, show the public all the stuff that's going on in their system and be uber transparent about it, but they can keep all of the players in that party in check. But, you know, to your point, public blockchains for sure, just with the amount of people, the amount of money that will be flowing through those systems, public blockchains will be, you know, the main thing, sort of like the internet is the main thing right now, but people still have, you know, private databases, private intranets, things like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the intranet still exists, right? But how many people really use the intranet?
Exactly.
On a percentage basis is pretty low. Just kind of quickly, what's your view on, you know, every industry that involves trust will be revolutionized, but I really believe that, you know, people won't actually know they're using blockchain technology. Like, I don't think they're going to be like, oh wow, we're using blockchain now. Like, I think it's going to be so integrated into the back end whereby it'll be seamless and you'll have no idea.
Oh, I totally agree. I think a lot of what people are doing now, you know, my grandma uses Facebook, but she doesn't know she's using the internet. She's just, you know, on her iPad typing away with her cousins. And, you know, she has no idea how it works or what's behind it or anything. And I think it'll be the same for the next generation of apps, which will just be decentralized apps. So she may be using a decentralized Facebook and maybe she can earn some money when one of her posts gets a lot of likes or goes viral because she, you know, post some cute story about a new blanket she knitted or something. But you know, there will be definitely, you know, little differences like, oh, I can make money by adding value to the decentralized Twitter or decentralized Facebook. But for the most part, most people won't even know or care that they're using a blockchain. It'll just be, oh, you know, hey, I got this new app and it pays me to do something, or I got this new app and I can do this thing that I couldn't do in a centralized app before.
Awesome, dude. Well, listen, Rob, we've got to wrap things up, man, but your time is always a privilege to be part of. So thank you so much for making it on the show today, dude. It's always great hearing your insights and expertise.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. You know, it's awesome to be able to come out and meet you guys in person and see the whole SVK crypto team and the awesome community you guys are building there. So please keep it up and I hope to see you guys again in the future.
Absolutely. Hey, are you going to be in San Fran, right? We're going to try and sort out a mentorship or something cool.
Yeah, looks like I should be a mentor at the San Francisco Hackathon. I'd love to do it. I saw that you and some other guys from SVK were mentors there at this last hackathon, and I'm excited to jump down that rabbit hole and be engaged as well.
Oh, dude, it was insane, man. Listen, we're gonna make you a mentor. We're going to do it. Let's do it. Awesome. Let's make it happen, dude.
Let's do it.
Let's see you in San Fran, baby.
Yeah, absolutely.
A big thank you once again to Mr. Rob Finch for making you on the show today. Really appreciate his time as always. And of course, you, the listener, thank you so much for doing what you're doing, being part of our journey. That is the 15 Minutes of Crypto Fame podcast. Without you, we couldn't be doing this. So remember, as always, that if you enjoyed today's show, all that we ask is that you leave a nice review and give us a good rating. We're always looking for feedback. We're always looking to improve. We're always looking to move forward with the podcast. And of course, you can reach out to us on our Telegram, SVK Crowd. If you type that into Telegram, you will find us on our community page where you have myself, Charles Story, and you have the rest of the SVK crypto team available 24/7 for any of your questions that you may have. And if you're really on your game, you can email myself, cstory, C-S-T-O-R-R-Y, at svkcrypto.com. And to stay up to date with all of our content, all of our pictures, all the events that we go to, please head over to Twitter at svk_crypto. That is the epicenter where all the pictures are displayed, along with our Telegram. If you join both, you'll be in a powerful position. I promise you that. So let's go. Let's make it happen and join our ever-growing community. We want everyone to be part of it. So let's make that happen. And of course, thank you, the listener, for not only your time, but most importantly, your attention. That's a wrap, and I gotta bounce.
You've been listening to an SVK Crypto Podcast original. Follow us on Twitter at SVK_crypto. Email us on cstory@svkcrypto.com. Leave us a message on our website, www.svkcrypto.com.